You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A group of Marquette University law students and community members conducted a series of restorative justice exercises recently with incarcerated men at the Racine Correctional Institution. That was earlier in the fall. These restorative justice circles brought the participants together to promote understanding and healing between people who have been harmed and people who have caused that harm. It's an alternative or a supplement to more punitive approaches to justice. And these types of restorative practices are also being used in places like schools to promote better participation and mental health among students. Our next guest is a former judge who's leading this effort from Marquette University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have any experience with restorative justice? Do you like the idea of restorative justice practices? What questions do you have about what it is and how it works? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Mary Trajano is an adjunct professor of law and director of the Andrew Center for Restorative Justice at Marquette University. She is a former chief judge for the Milwaukee County Circuit Court. Mary, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob. Much appreciated.
Restorative justice has gotten a fair amount of attention recently, but for those who aren't familiar, can you give us the basics of the concept?
Absolutely. So restorative justice really is a unique way of approaching harm from crime or wrongdoing. The easiest way to sort of discern it is to compare it to the traditional system of justice. And the traditional system is focused on retribution or punishment, but restorative justice focuses on righting the wrong and moving towards healing. What it invites us to do is it helps us to try to hold people who harm directly accountable for its repair, but it also, and a very important, gives survivors a voice so that they can begin to recover and hopefully heal. So restorative justice is really a framework in appropriate instances that can hopefully accomplish both of those.
Now, what caught our eye and had us give you a call this time around was this thing you did at the Racine Correctional Institution with people who are currently incarcerated. Can you talk us through what actually happened?
Sure, absolutely. And I'm excited because it's my first attempt to facilitate circles on my own. So I'd like to start with the fact that Marquette University Law School is not unfamiliar with restorative justice. Mm-hmm. Former Justice Jeanine Geske ran the Restorative Justice Initiative for probably 20 years at Marquette University Law School. And she started out with hosting restorative justice circles at Green Bay Correctional and had been doing that for about 20 years. And back when I was a baby judge, just starting out, I was invited by Justice Geske to participate in a circle. And that participation really transformed my view of restorative justice and how we can move people towards healing. So 20 years later, I'm now in a position to facilitate restorative justice circles at Racine Correctional, not Green Bay. And our first restorative justice circle was in early November. So restorative justice circles are really a structured process based upon and rooted in indigenous practices. We take a lot of our practices when we do circles from our Native American friends, who used circles to connect humans together, to have people heal from wrongs. And so it's not a new practice, but it's certainly a positive one. So Rob, what we did was I invited community members and law students who I teach in my clinical program to Racine, and Racine Correctional invited about 18 incarcerated men. And for 3 days, we community build, get to know each other, try to understand each other's backgrounds and histories and why we're there. I also have three what we call surrogate victims, not victims of the men who are in circle, but victims of crime and wrongdoing who tell their story over pretty much a full day during the circle process. One was a victim of a gunshot wound from a youth who had shot him trying to steal his car. Another was a victim of sexual assault pretty egregious sexual assault, actually twice in her life. And then the third lost her child to a drunk driver. And they tell their stories in such an incredibly passionate way and share their grief and pain, but also share their joy of how they came to heal. And the men and community get an opportunity to listen to their voices. And as I say, in most circles, empathy after they tell their stories is pretty palpable. And that's what we wish for. We want people to understand the ripple effect of harm and crime so that they can empathize with the other, build community, and hopefully move towards healing. And that's what we did.
We're talking about restorative justice with Mary Trigiano with Marquette University's Center, Andrew Center for Restorative Justice, former chief judge from the Milwaukee County Circuit Court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about restorative justice, if you've participated in it at some level, join in at 800-642-1234. Mary, I want to talk about the people who have been victimized by crime and were willing to do this. I think no one would blame them if they said, no thanks, I don't want to relive this. I don't want to be talking to people who might have perpetrated similar crimes. Can you talk about why they got involved in this?
Yes, absolutely. So I always say restorative justice is not for everyone, and a survivor needs to be willing to want to share their story. And two of our storytellers, our survivors, have been doing this for many years. In fact, they did it with Justice Geske when she first started doing circles back 20 years ago. And they say that telling their story is very healing for them. It gives them an opportunity to explain, you know, what happened to them or to their loved one. And share with the individuals, the community members, and those who have harmed in much greater detail than you'd ever get to do in the traditional system of justice. One of the survivors says, I probably have saved countless dollars of therapy doing it this way because I want to bring attention to men who are incarcerated, the significant impact of crime and harm that occurred so that they understand and can empathize with those that they have harmed.
What is the benefit or the hoped for benefit now when that incarcerated person who's been convicted of a crime goes through something like this? What are the hopes that they get out of this down the road?
Yeah, I think when you build community and trust and empathy and even let the men tell their stories of trauma and harm that they endured when they were younger, it in many ways changes you for the better. And I think the hope is that, and some of these men will get out of prison and go on hopefully to live life in the community crime-free, that they have a deeper understanding of the harms that they had committed before they were incarcerated. And then it will deter them from doing further harm or try to help and repair in ways that the community deserves to be repaired after their harm. And so we hope that their lives are changed forever. For those who likely will not be leaving incarceration for any time soon, many of them, I think, have had transformations in terms of better behavior in the institution. Several of them want to start a restorative justice ongoing program for others in the institution so that they can benefit by understanding the harms that they committed. And so there's a ripple effect in that way as well.
People might hear about this, Mary, and say, okay, this sounds nice, maybe for one person at a time. Is there any kind of data? Has this been done enough to have any kind of data on whether restorative justice affects things like recidivism or future committing of crimes?
Yeah. So restorative justice has been around for probably 30 years now. It started in the early 70s, mostly used with youth who are committing crimes, and a lot of studies have been done on that. Many of the studies suggest that there is a reduction in recidivism for those who participate in certain kinds and types of restorative justice. There's a higher satisfaction level for victims and survivors of crime who go through restorative justice processes. And then there's some deeper data and research going on right now to see if there are other benefits to the community of restorative justice. Like, for instance, does it build stronger communities? Does it, you know, help people stay out of prison so that stronger communities can be built once they return to their home?
We're talking to law professor Mary Trigiano about restorative justice and her work as director of the Andrew Center for Restorative Justice at Marquette University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these ideas as you're hearing them? How should they fit into our criminal justice system? Have you participated in some sort of restorative justice practice, program, one of the circles we've talked about, or training? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Mary Trigiano, former chief judge for the Milwaukee County Circuit Court. She currently directs the Andrew Center for Restorative Justice at Marquette University. She's with us today to talk about restorative justice and a recent Marquette Law School project hosting restorative justice circles with incarcerated men at Racine Correctional Institution. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your reactions to this idea, maybe your own experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Ellie is with us in Brookfield. Or Elle, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
So I was just saying to the other girl that answered the phone that I was incarcerated in the Wisconsin prison system for about a year and a half. And I noticed that y'all were talking about the men's system a lot, which is great. But what about the women? Because I feel like the women get left behind a lot in these kinds of projects.
Well, thanks a lot for the call. Mary, have we had restorative justice programs at women's correctional institutions?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we certainly don't want to leave anyone behind. Justice Jeanine Geske had been working somewhat with Tachita, trying to get circles there. There are some rules, certainly, that they have at some of the prisons. But we also did and are continuing to work with Project Return to do some circle processes at the Women's Correctional Facility just north of downtown Milwaukee. And they've been doing circles of support there for women for some time now. So we hope to increase our capacity at the Andrews Center to help and support that and use students to actually go in and help facilitate circles there.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Rob joins us now in Madison. Rob, hi.
Hi. I was a participant in a program, and this is a huge subject for me. And, you know, I'll just confirm what your guest said, that the programs are not for everybody. And for instance, the people I did time with, a lot of them would just take a program to reap the benefit of, for instance, getting out early or, to use it to their own ends and not for the learning experience. So the people that I did the program with, I would say there was 12 of us, about 10 of us got through it with coming out with something. So again, I have a lot more to say on it, but I just wanted to confirm what she had said, that it is true. It is not for everybody.
Well, I want to ask Rob, since you went through restorative justice, what did you feel like you got out of it?
Oh, geez. Again, we don't have enough time for that, but I'll just say a better understanding, more empathy for the victim, because when you go through that part of the program, as far as victimization and re-victimization, you feel even smaller and more terrible than you did before. I mean, but they guide you through to get you back to, you know, not feeling so bad about what you did. So again, it was a great program that I went through, and I've taken it. I'm looking to take it a step further now that I'm out. But again, one thing at a time.
So, okay, I got to ask Rob, what would the next step be? Sorry, before I let you go.
Helping others.
Excellent. Rob, thank you so much for sharing that experience. Mary, Rob got a lot out of it, but feels like some people might just game the system with something like this.
Yeah, congratulations, Rob, and I appreciate you calling in and talking about your experience and having 10 out of 12 really get good experience from it is, you know, to me hopeful. But, you know, I understand that as well. It's a voluntary program at the Racine Correctional. In fact, they put it out there because we could only accommodate about 18 individual men at Racine Correctional. It's my understanding they had about 120 that signed up for it. So we'll be going back each semester to host a new set of men in circle. And the hope is that, just like with Rob, they get something out of it so that it can transform and change their lives for the better. And it sounds like that's what Rob is going to do. And I think the majority of people ultimately do that as well.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rob, at 800-642-1234. Jeremy joins us now in Mineral Point. Jeremy, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me on. I just simply want to say thank you for having this conversation. I've come to learn that restorative justice and circles have Aboriginal Native American roots. So I'm wondering to what extent we can speak to maybe the influence the culture has on the processes and its intention, you know, that has been set forth for a very long time. And then in addition to that, I'm hearing a lot of callers, you know, call in and talk about people misusing and taking advantage of the process. But I just want to have folks understand that this is a process that's individualized and is special and unique to each person and each group that's involved. And it's important to be thinking about radical forgiveness, right, as a process for getting beyond and making sure people transform instead of staying stuck in punitive measures and harming people to teach a lesson.
Jeremy, thanks so much for the call, Jeremy. Mary, we mentioned the indigenous roots of that at the outset of the show. Thanks for reminding me of that, Jeremy. But that idea of forgiveness versus a punitive approach, is that an accurate depiction of restorative justice, Mary?
Yeah, thanks for the call, and you hit the nail on the head. It can be about forgiveness, but it doesn't have to be about forgiveness. I think many of our survivors would say, "I am not going to forgive the person, but I want to have a dialogue with them about the questions about why it happened to me, why, you know, what can you do to help repair that harm? If it leads to forgiveness, that's good, but it doesn't always have to, and it doesn't always lead to forgiveness."
Thanks again for that call, Jeremy, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Mary Trajano with the Andrew Center for Restorative Justice at Marquette University. Mary, I want to talk about another venue now. We've been focusing on corrections so far. Schools are looking into restorative justice programs. What kind of things are you seeing out there?
Yeah, great question. In fact, you know, restorative justice can be done in many types of situations. It can be done in businesses, in schools. Wherever there's a harm or wherever there's a wrong or wrongdoing and you want to use a restorative justice process, there's many ways that can be done. But schools have adopted restorative practices for many, many years. And I know when I first began learning about restorative justice about 20 some years ago, the district attorney's office here in Milwaukee was working in Milwaukee Public Schools with others to facilitate restorative justice circles or community conferencing, which is a different form of restorative justice. And so, you know, if you ask the question, who was harmed, what is that harm and the ripple effect of that harm and how can we repair that harm and put it into a school system, it has some unique benefits, just like restorative justice has in the justice system. So grade schools, high schools, I know Marquette University is looking at, like other universities of higher education, using restorative practices in terms of discipline or wrongdoing on campus or disputes amongst individuals. You know, it is about having a civil dialogue, which is very difficult for us to have in these times, right? Actually sit in a circle or sit in a community conferencing and have a facilitated civil dialogue with each other that can lead to healing and not more harm doing.
I wanted to ask before we run out of time, Mary, just in our last minute, about training for people facilitating these circles. I've heard anecdotally from some schools, from staff and students that, you know, there's kind of an announcement. We're doing restorative practices, limited training. It went, not surprisingly, poorly. What goes into making somebody ready to be a facilitator?
That's a great question. And I'm still learning from the best, which is Justice Geske and others. I think to be a really true good facilitator of a restorative justice dialogue, you have to certainly stick to best practices, learn from the best, be critiqued, be willing to be critiqued so that you can increase your capacity to do so. Because the last thing we want to do is go in and re-harm somebody or individuals where the focus is to heal from harm that has happened. And so training, being critiqued on how you're doing it, giving it time to grow within you, I think is really, really important to becoming a good facilitator of restorative justice dialogues.
Mary, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Very well. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Mary Trigiano, adjunct professor of law, director of the Andrew Center for Restorative Justice at Marquette University. She's a former chief judge from the Milwaukee County Circuit Court. She told us some about work that the center has been doing on restorative justice, including at the Racine Correctional Institution. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, COVID was a major emergency for the public health field, and there are a lot of lessons still to be learned, according to the author of the new book, Within Reason, A Liberal Public Health for an Illiberal Time. The author joins the show. And CTE, a chronic brain injury, has been a growing concern for pro football players. What do we know about the risks facing young athletes in a variety of sports? Wisconsin expert joins us with the latest research. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the U.S. Postal Service could face some big changes in the coming years under a plan from the Postmaster General. We'll find out what's at stake and what it means for your mail and package deliveries. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The holiday season is the peak time of year for mail and package delivery. In 2022, the U.S. Postal Service processed 12 billion packages for the entire holiday season. But even with billions of successfully delivered packages, the agency is still losing billions of dollars a year. To get back on track, the Postal Service is set to put into practice a bunch of changes aimed at cutting labor costs, modernizing the delivery system, and making the service more financially viable. Regulators have expressed concerns about the plan, which they say could bring more changes than the agency has seen in effect since Ben Franklin was Postmaster General. Our next guest has been following the developments closely and is here for a look at what's ahead for the U.S. Postal Service in 2024 and beyond. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What was your experience sending and receiving cards and packages over the holiday season? Did you notice delays, or was everything delivered on time? Are there changes in services you'd like to see from the post office? If you work for the Postal Service, love to hear your perspective on how things are going now, what you hope for, or maybe fear in possible changes over the next couple of years. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Jory Heckman is a reporter at Federal News Network, where he covers federal workers, technology, and data in government and the U.S. Postal Service. Jory, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks for having me.
Now, we've heard hopes, at least from the Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, that we'd be having, you know, break-even years by now. That didn't end up happening, it looks like, in 2023. Can you talk about the shortfall and why that happened?
Sure. Yeah, that shortfall between what the Postmaster General expected financially for this year and what it actually got, the reason why there's that disparity is two big things. One was the rate of inflation going beyond the Postal Service's initial projections. And the other thing is just that the Postal Service saw a higher cost ultimately for its pension plans for its some of its employees. So between those two things, they were way off the mark of what they expected, did not break even in fiscal 2023 like they expected. And they said that in fiscal 2024, it's going to be more of the same, that they're going to see a similar $6-point-some-odd-billion loss for that fiscal year ahead and not break even as well.
I want to talk, before we get into plan changes, talk about some of the fundamental things that are driving these shortfalls. One big one, I guess, Jory, from reading your reporting and elsewhere, we just don't send letters like we used to.
Yeah, I mean, that is a huge reason for why the Postal Service is going through these financial woes. A first-class letter is the most profitable product for the Postal Service when you just look at the margin of what it costs to deliver that letter and what kind of revenue it's getting as a result of that letter. And so that is one thing that has just gone down and down and down. And there's just been, if you look back historically, mail volume has gone down significantly when we saw the 2008 recession. There's something in the order of, I've heard estimates of 30 to 40% of mail volume went away then and really never came back. And as we look at the damage done from the COVID-19 pandemic, there's some estimates that it could be a similar type decline in mail volume as a result of that and the economic toll that it took on everyone. So the Postal Service is obviously, from the perspective of delivering things, in a better spot than we were in 2020 and 2021. But in terms of its overall business model, that's still a thing that they are reeling from in a big way.
And Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, you've reported on this. You interviewed him last year, sounding the alarm, saying, hey, no, we're not going to run out of money next week. But in 5 years ago or so, can you talk about the sense of urgency that the Postmaster General is sending out here?
Yeah, urgency is a good word for it. The way that he describes things, and when I was interviewing him last year, everything from his point of view should have been done yesterday. He's a man of urgency and wanting his plans implemented very quickly. And so what he's really sketched out for this year and the years ahead is a cut in costs. It was in the order of billions of dollars a year, and an increase in revenue of about the same amount. And so the way that they're trying to do that is they're trying to consolidate some aspects of its massive nationwide delivery network, bringing some things together, merging some aspects of its operations together. One big thing that they are trying to do is bring the letter carrier side of things, your door-to-door mail carrier, bringing the post office delivery operation and the sorting aspect of the Postal Service, bringing that under one roof as a mega center called a sorting and delivery center. And so that won't be anything that most people will expect to see in terms of their day-to-day interactions with the Postal Service, but this is a massive rethinking of the Postal Service's network.
Talking to Jory Hackman with the Federal News Network, looking at the U.S. Postal Service, still seeing some financial challenges, big changes potentially in the works. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your hopes, your fears for possible changes, whether you're a postal customer. Do you send packages directly via USPS a lot? Join in at 800-642-1234. Jory, let's dig more into that change. This idea of these super centers, there's a name for them. I can't remember it. Oh, here it is. The sorting and delivery centers, these massive things. Where are we on that? Are these starting to spring up?
We have seen them crop up last year, and we're going to see that accelerate this year. The idea is what we've seen from these sorting and delivery centers so far is that they would be one at a time. The idea is that what we might see in 2024 is kind of waves of these being launched. The first one of these that we saw was in Athens, Georgia. And what that really meant for people is that it was letter carriers starting their days at these massive super centers as opposed to their neighborhood post offices. And what we had heard from USPS management is that might result in these letter carriers having to drive a little bit further of a commute to start their days, in the order of 5 to 10, 15 minutes maybe tacked onto their commutes. But the thing that is, an open question really is what this is going to mean for the USPS workforce overall, with fewer facilities, fewer places where this mail is being sorted and delivered, what that's going to mean for those employees, and also what it's going to mean for those USPS clerks, the people that you go to a counter at and you order stamps or you hand them your package that you want to get delivered. USPS says that there will be no layoffs as a result of this rethinking of its network. But one thing that we have been seeing some elements of is that the USPS is saying that there will be no layoffs, but that there might be jobs moved elsewhere, moved across state lines. And so if you have a job that's being moved 200 or 100 miles away, it really is a thing where you may not actively, you may not want that job, and you may actually find yourself leaving the Postal Service.
People might hear this and say, well, hang on, I go to my local post office to drop off that package and buy my stamps or maybe get my passport or whatever. Are people going to have to drive to these super centers, or are these local post offices going to stay as they are?
So an important thing to bring up here is that the Postal Service has said, in addition to its no layoff pledge, that the retail aspect of its business, that its customers shouldn't see a change there. So that doesn't mean a closure in post offices for people who need those day-to-day services like buying stamps or getting their package sent off.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Cindy is with us in Stevens Point. Cindy, hi.
Hi. I guess my remark is, I think that the internet and Facebook has really done away with people sending cards, writing letters. They're doing it over the internet instead of writing that letter. And to me, that is not personal. I don't want to hear Merry Christmas or I'm sorry somebody died over the internet. I want that personal letter, that personal card in the mail. And so I'm 64 years old, and I'm afraid that in the future there isn't going to be a postal service.
Cindy, thanks a lot for that call. Joria, the Postal Service wants, I think, more people out there like Cindy sending those personal cards, but that the trend seems to be away from that.
Yeah, I mean, what we've seen over the decades is that, correct, that what we've seen is the mail decline is real, that we've seen fewer people send fewer amounts of letters using the Postal Service. And so that is a real problem. That is something that the Postal Service is trying to think about its business model overall. One thing that we have kind of seen from its leadership is that they're trying to capture a bigger piece of the package pie from people like USPS, from FedEx and other, from Amazon and these other shipping giants here. And so that is one way they're trying to capture more revenue, is just to really lean heavily onto that package side of things. But of course, letters is something where the USPS has a monopoly. This is something that only it can do, but that no longer feels like a reliable means of revenue for the organization. It feels like something it has to do, but the revenue side of that is drying up. And so there might be some ray of good news. I know that some postal watchdogs, like the USPS Inspector General's Office, they've looked at generational use of the mail. And what they have seen is from Gen Z and newer generations that are being future customers here, that they are more heavy users of mail. They enjoy getting letters. And so maybe as we see these new customers emerge, that might be a slight trend in the right direction here.
Thanks for that call, Cindy. We're talking to Jory Heckman, reporter at Federal News Network. We're talking about his latest reporting on the U.S. Postal Service and its future. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you count on your local post office for one thing or another? Do you work for the Postal Service here in Wisconsin or beyond? Has your job changed at all? A lot, maybe in the next few years? Do you have concerns about the ongoing 10-year plan to make big changes? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Jory Heckman from the Federal News Network about the latest news out of the U.S. Postal Service as the agency moves forward with their 10-year plan aimed at breaking even financially. You could join in with your thoughts, your experiences, sending mail, delivering the mail, or sorting it yourself. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jory, before we go back to our callers, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, not a universally beloved figure, getting pushed back on some of his plans from postal workers and unions, from members of Congress and others. What are some of the main objections, concerns that people have raised about DeJoy and his leadership?
Well, the one thing that they're really concerned about at this stage is, you know, what this means, this 10-year plan, and what this reimagining of the USPS network is going to mean for its workforce and what it's going to mean for its customers. Those are two things that we've heard the assurances that there will be no layoffs as a result of this plan. But one thing is that the USPS, their total overall costs, about 70% of them are labor costs in some way. And so, you know, one thing that they have looked at is reducing overall labor hours, work hours, you know, tried to reduce that, you know, several million work hours last year, and an additional reduction of several million work hours this year, just trying to reduce those labor costs where they can. But it's a very big question about what the future USPS workforce is going to look like. And for these people who work in facilities, that there are talks of moving those facilities elsewhere, consolidating those facilities with existing ones, what ultimately that's going to mean. And that's where Congress is getting involved at this point. We've seen letters, we've seen town halls where members of Congress are fielding these concerns, and they're bringing them to the Postmaster General, asking them, you know, are there jobs that are going to be leaving my district? Are there jobs that are going to be leaving my state? And so that's where we currently are with a lot of these things. And we don't have good answers quite yet.
Let's go back to our callers. Cynthia is with us now in Madison. Hi, Cynthia.
Hello. I think that the Postal Service is an essential government function, and I think it's part of our public infrastructure. And it's unrealistic and unnecessary to require them to be self-supporting. I think that this is something that's worthy of taxpayer support. A post office is probably the only touch with the federal government that many communities have. And it just seems to be a worthy pursuit. It's the same thing as requiring public transportation to be self-supporting. Some of this stuff is public good, and it needs public support.
Cynthia, thanks a lot for that call. And people have flipped that around, Jory, and said, you know, the requirement by law is the Postal Service has to, you know, maybe provide mail service to a rural part of Alaska where it costs them a lot of money. They can't just cut that service. So Cynthia's point about this being a public good, talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think that really strikes a nerve with a lot of people who are heavy users of the Postal Service, that it is this essential function, and that they're really, their value to the country is that they go everywhere. They go door to door in places that other, you know, commercial giants like Amazon or FedEx or UPS wouldn't necessarily go. They go to, you know, some major metropolitan hubs and beyond that, but they may not go to rural Alaska, to your example. And so I think that's one thing that, you know, everyone is very cognizant about. I think what we've seen, especially with some recent coverage on this topic, is that, you know, rural carriers in a lot of places are being inundated with some of these Amazon packages. You know, we saw some coverage in the Washington Post about this not too long ago in rural areas where the staffing is meant to accommodate the mail volume that they've been getting. And then all of a sudden this deluge of Amazon packages happen. And all of a sudden they're scrambling to try to deal with that new workload.
Oh, thanks for that call, Cynthia. Speaking of those rural carriers, you reported back in November about some of those rural carriers not getting their paychecks on time a couple times last year. What happened?
Yeah, so what we saw initially was in early September, the USPS, they said that there was a major glitch in its payroll system that, as a result, about 50,000 rural carriers, some part-time, some full-time, would not be getting their full paycheck or their entire paycheck on time for what that first pay period in September. And that was a situation where it took, in some cases, multiple pay periods for USPS to finally give them that paycheck that they were entitled to. They did, as a stopgap solution, offer them a money order as what they called a salary advance. And so they did some calculations. They said this is probably a percentage of your gross pay. We think this is ultimately what your take-home pay would be. And so we had worked that out at that point. And then what we saw the week of Thanksgiving is that same problem persist on a much smaller scale. About 2,200 employees were affected then. It was actually a different technical issue, we were told, that was the result of that. But again, tough to not get the paycheck you were expecting the week of Thanksgiving. And so the National Rural Letter Carriers Association represents rural carriers. They have raised some concerns about this. They have filed a national level grievance demanding that USPS put measures in place to prevent this kind of thing from happening again. But as we talk about the workforce and making sure that USPS has the staffing it needs to deliver mail, deliver packages, this is not the kind of thing that they want out there that's happening, employees that are not getting paid the amount that they're owed.
Talking about the U.S. Postal Service with Jory Heckman, reporter at Federal News Network. Back to your calls. Brian is with us in Madison. Brian, hi.
Hi. Similar to what Cynthia said, I guess I'm a bit confused on why we expect the Postal Service to make money. We don't expect fire departments to make money. If some of these groups like Amazon are abusing the system and adding that additional strain, should we just start charging them more?
Brian, thanks a lot for the call. First of all, Jory, what's some of the history behind that? I think it goes back to the 70s, the self-sustaining Postal Service idea.
Yeah, since the 1970s, the USPS has been under this model where they are largely self-funded through their own revenue. They get some very modest appropriations from Congress for some things like free mail for the blind, some very niche things. But by and large, they do self-fund, and they've been under this model since the 1970s. And there's been some talk of, you know, some postal experts out there wondering if that's a sufficient model for the years to come here. When you think about other comparable services, you know, people point to Amtrak and say that, you know, that is an organization that gets congressional funding from Congress every year. And so, you know, is that a model that makes a little bit more sense, that they get some stream of congressional funding? There are, of course, people who oppose that idea, but for the time being, you know, people really rely on the Postal Service, and, you know, there's a strong need for it to keep functioning in some way, shape, or form. And so that might be an option that people can consider. That's something Congress has considered for a while. I think it's worth pointing out that Congress only in 2022, they passed a large Postal Service Reform Bill, the Postal Service Reform Act, and that was supposed to deal with the Postal Service's financial problems. Clearly, it has not done everything that lawmakers have hoped it would do. It did kind of erase and wipe the slate clean for some of the Postal Service's financial obligations. It was supposed to pre-fund retiree health benefits well into the future. And so they're now under a pay-as-you-go system, which has been helpful for them. But there's clearly still things that they have still to work out that they have not done just yet.
Brian, thanks a lot for that call. Jory, in our last half a minute or so, what is the next big story you're watching from the Postal Service?
Well, I think it'll be really interesting to see the overall metrics for the holiday season that was. Obviously, it is a massive undertaking every year, but I'll be curious to see how these numbers compare to the previous holiday season, whether it will surpass that. Obviously, with the Postal Service looking intently at increased package volume, whether they actually did deliver more packages this year. And, you know, if not, then that's going to be something that they're going to have to take a hard look at and see what more they can do to boost that package.
Jory, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jory Heckman, reporter at Federal News Network. He covers federal workers, technology, and data in government and the U.S. Postal Service. He's with us for a look at a lot of news going on at USPS, including plans to modernize the postal network and what that means for postal workers and people who mail stuff. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.